Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. We're spending time during the month of October talking about the future of farming in South Dakota, the future of the ag industry. So what does the farm of the future look like? What are farmers today doing to stay ahead and look ahead for future generations? Today we welcome Nick Jorgensen with Jorgensen Land and Cattle Partnerships from the ideal South Dakota area. He's a fourth generation. It's a fourth generation family owned and operated farm and ranch. And Nick has a master's in economics, so we're going to talk a little money. Nick, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
I want to start with this idea that, first of all, money can be hard to talk about. Economics and finances can be difficult to talk about for anybody, maybe particularly farmers. Do you find that people have a hard time sort of getting into the conversation, or is it just, you know, you breathe the conversation because money is so important on a daily basis in ag?
Well, in my experience, you know, you do find people that aren't willing to discuss details like that. You know, that makes sense. You know, it's natural. This is a personal thing. Farming and ranching for a lot of people is not a business to them. It's their life. And so to ask them to talk, you know, finances, a lot of times you're basically asking them to tell you the balance in their bank account. And that can make some people uncomfortable. But if you can get past that and really frame the discussion around talking about a business, I do think it makes things easier to talk money and finance. And the other thing I will tell you, and I don't like to sound overly critical of my peers, but unfortunately, I think a lot of operations maybe just simply don't know their costs as well as they should. And so it's difficult to talk because they don't always know the answer.
Right, which would not be any different than looking at people's personal business account, because often if you ask that question, people would say, I don't know. I mean, they don't know what they're spending and where on groceries and food and stops at the gas station. So, but the consequences of that, the consequences of that are pretty significant. You're born in like the early 90s, right? And for your farm, it has already transitioned at that point to no-till and cover crops, tell me about when you come into the family as a child and really what's happening on the farm at that time, and then how it affects you as you try to figure out what, you know, before and after as the operation changes.
So my dad started no-tilling in 1991, which consequently was the year I was born.
Yeah.
So I've never known anything different than the system that we have currently in place today. And now over time, you know, the introduction of cover crops and things like that have occurred more recently, the last 10 to 15 years. And to be 100% honest with you, when I was young, the concept of turning cattle back onto our farmland, putting up a fence and letting, you know, cows or bulls graze out there was an absolute no-no. We didn't want that to happen. We were worried about compaction. We were worried about destroying our ground, and so we didn't do it. Well, in recent years, we've kind of learned that's really less of a concern, and it was frankly wrong. And so we've focused more on getting cattle back out there, you know, using our cover crops, grazing cows or bulls on them, to get that holistic management style and take advantage of the efficiencies that lie in there.
Let's talk a little bit about the because as we have many of these conversations, you know, we have authors who come in and philosophers who come in and farmers and policymakers who come in, and a lot of people will talk about regenerative ag and the benefits of it, and then everybody says, yeah, but how much does it cost? And then how much does it save? So let's talk about some of those general principles, because your operation is going to be different from a lot of people's, but it might be instructive. What's the cost of the transition from to no-till, for example? Let's start there.
Well, that's a little bit more difficult a one for me to speak to, once again, because that occurred for us so long ago.
Sure. Yeah.
That, you know, and back then we probably didn't track costs as well as we should have, so it's tough to reference historically 28 years in any business. but the point is, and I can only speak, you know, anecdotally to this, but in our part of the world, the cost is not that tough, you know, not that big of a thing to overcome. We're not an extremely wet portion of the state here in South Central South Dakota, and generally the argument when you're going to switch from a tillage system to a no-till system, the first question is, well, what am I going to do with all my water? Because that's the primary incentive for a lot of people to be under a tillage system. And, you know, we don't experience that issue here. We're significantly drier, and so the cost to switch and the downside of switching is much, much lower. You know, for our operation, I don't know that there really ever was that we noticed a significant cost, and we started to see the benefits right away because we were retaining water. We were passing over the field less. I can share that with you. You know, in general, our machinery cost per acre is going to be $30 to $60 less than in a tillage system.
Why is that? Just because you're not tilling?
We are not going across the field as
much.
That's
it. Okay. So that adds up in a variety of different ways. How about from a spraying or a nutrient application perspective? Are there cost savings there?
You know, we operate our business on kind of a minimal input system. You know, a lot of people in no-till maybe don't operate that way. We've chosen to do that. You know, it's more of a minimized cost and get your most efficient bushel as you can. And so, naturally, we apply less fertilizer. We apply less, you know, herbicides just because that's the choice we've chosen to make. Now, it is foreseeable in a no-till scenario if you were going to manage differently, you know, you could see yourself having higher chemical costs or, you know, higher fertilizer costs than we do. But once again, we've not taken the max yield approach. Because, you know, a max yield approach doesn't always mean that's your most efficient or cheap bushels. We've rather gone for let's minimize the cost we can get out of a bushel of corn or a bushel of wheat here in our operation. And therefore, all that stuff is generally lower.
All right, so talk about the max yield approach and what would you call your approach then? I mean, talk about the benefits of sort of looking at that kind of, you know, way of looking at your operation in the first place.
Okay, so I've ran a few numbers here at home. Now, if you were to follow, you know, say university recommendations off of a soil test and apply the specified amount of nitrogen and phosphorus that an agronomist would tell you based on recommendations to get, say, 175 bushel corn, which in Tripp County, South Dakota, is a phenomenal corn yield to shoot for. If you were to follow that and then and compare that against our cost, we've got $60 to $90 less in fertility costs, and in general, we can still hit yields very close to 175 if we get moisture. And so, you know, we give up a little, but, you know, on a cost per bushel basis, it's much lower to give up 5 to 10 bushel and reduce your cost by $60 to $90.
Right. So you really, again, you have to do that math in order to see.
You have to do the math, and you've got to know your cost.
Yeah.
You got to take the time to do it.
Right, to see the big picture, you really have to understand. Otherwise, it's just it's max yield, get as much as you can, and you're looking at the input without really looking at your costs. I get it. I mean, I get it a little bit more than I did. I'm like,
max output. How many gross dollars can I pull off this field? And you lose the whole concept of, well, can I reduce the dollars I'm putting into it?
Right.
And get a similar, more efficient bushel.
Okay. You have native prairie in your operation as well, right?
Yes, ma'am.
Tell me how that sort of fits into the big picture of what you're trying to do.
Yeah, well, we run a cow herd here in north central Tripp County. And one of the things we focused on the last few years is getting to a more rotational grazing system. Mm-hmm. We've been set up to do it for many years. My uncle actually worked with the NRCS years ago to set up some of our larger pastures into smaller paddocks for grazing. And we just management-wise kind of got away from it. Well, we've transitioned back to moving these cows twice weekly, which is a tough thing to do. We're going to run 1,000-plus cows in our operation, and that's very labor-intense to do that on a scale like that. But what we found is we're bringing our native prairie back to the state that we believe it should be. We're seeing fewer invasive non-native species like brome grass, for example. And we're really starting to see our wheatgrasses come back in because we're not stressing those more fragile native plants. And we're increasing our production as well. It can be a little bit deceiving on a year like 2019 where we've just been inundated with rain. Mm-hmm. And therefore, everything just looks phenomenal. But we use it as an insurance policy. We have more grass for these cows to graze per acre. We don't push it and graze it harder. Mm-hmm. we use it to bank up for 2020 when it doesn't rain. We've got that grass there for them.
Are there other areas that you can speak to from your operation that have been a sort of a successful, as you look at the cost analysis, that you've made decisions, you know, maybe in more recent years that have really benefited the operation as a whole?
Yes, and I'll tell you about the number one decision we've made that's benefited us probably more than anything else, and that's utilizing our crop residues and our cover crops that we're planting primarily behind winter wheat and grazing our bulls out on them. And I heard you say earlier that, you know, our operation is a little different in that we've got a lot of bulls. Not most people have as many bulls as we have around here. But the way we treat them is similar to how you would treat a cow. So as we have this discussion, just when I say bull, there can be interchangeable with a female as well.
Mm-hmm.
We graze a large amount of cattle on residue, like milo residue, cover crop, corn residue, where primarily we would do that or we would have them in a feedlot. And we've seen cost reductions in order of $1.50 to $2 a day reduction in carrying costs of those animals by getting them out of the feedlot and letting them graze the residue. We're gonna feed a bull on our lot for just round it to $2.50 a day when you kind of include everything. We can run a bull out on crop ground on residue for below $1, and a lot of cases in that 50 to 75 cent a day range.
Wow.
And so the cost savings there is immense. You know, when we talk about, you know, we had 500 bulls out doing that last year. And so for our bottom line, you extrapolate those numbers out over a season, and you know, that's big dollars, and it makes a difference for us.
So when you talk about how much rain you've had in the mud, then do you have to worry because of this season on the compaction? Is that the word? Sorry. Yes, compaction.
You know, we actually just did some tests here last week, and we were surprised. I shouldn't say we were surprised. We did find that, you know, compaction was a bit of an issue, especially if you're familiar with bulls. They're a difficult animal. They like to walk fence rows. They like to group up, and they like to dig holes. They're just a little tougher than a cow. You know, they're like a teenage,
right?
Like a high school boy, to be honest with you.
Yeah.
So if you can relate to that, and we did find some pretty some unfortunate compaction in some areas, but what we're hoping for is, you know, when you get a freeze and thaw cycle in our part of the world, that itself really can solve a lot of those problems. And with all the moisture we've had, that freeze and thaw is really going to expand that soil and should break up a lot of those compaction problems that we did see.
Yeah. Did you have an idea that the cost savings would be so, you know, so successful when you sort of, you know, went into looking at this new way of doing things? Or was it, you know, how much, I guess what I'm getting at here is how much is this experimentation and, you know, we think this is going to work, and how much of it is it, yep, we know this is going to work and now we just have to do it?
We did not realize that it was going to be as big as it is. You know, we knew. We went into this, it actually wasn't even done from an economic perspective, the original decision. The original decision was, let's get these cattle out grazing so that, you know, the manure that they're putting everywhere in the field and the way they pick, it was a soil health thing. We were hoping just for healthier soil, regardless of what the numbers were. And then additionally, we were also hoping for better animal health. You know, anytime you can get a four-legged critter out of a confined space and get them back out into a more open scenario, it is better for them.
Right.
And we've seen that physically with our bulls. It's just better. And so that was actually the idea. Let's take advantage of those benefits. And it just happened to be a byproduct that over and above those things, you know, we're saving $1 to $1.50 to even $2 a day in feed and in labor costs and in equipment costs on these cattle.
Right. Any other areas that you think you've looked at the cost analysis and really found some success in, you know, reducing your operation costs that might be useful to others?
Yeah, well, this year we did experiment a little with grazing cattle on some full season cover. And so just let me clarify the difference from what we do with our bulls. Our bulls typically graze after harvest. So right now, October 1st, we're turning cattle out to graze on residue. We actually tried this summer grazing cattle year-round from May 1st all the way through on some of our crop ground. We dedicated some acres, planted some some different forage crops to try, you know, with the intent of let's see what we can do cost-wise and if this makes sense versus just running, say, a set of heifers out on pasture.
Okay, sure.
And I kind of set a rule of thumb as if you can do something for $1 a day, you know, with a female, you're making a good choice because we can run, it's about $1 a day to run a heifer here, more or less. And so I set the benchmark at $1, and we did some experiments. And we did get mixed results. Some of these crops, you know, and the blends of different forages you put together and the way you manage the field, it can get a little bit expensive. We had a couple acres where it was over $2 a head a day, which is a little bit high for us. But what we found is if we can effectively double crop, and so I'll give you a practical example. We grazed some winter wheat. Starting about June 1st, grazed some heifers on it, grazed it until we had terminated that crop. We went in behind it and planted, say, like a forage sorghum or a cane of some sort.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a double crop. And we grazed it again, and that's very cost effective. You spread that cost out over time and across different, you know, two different crops, and it worked for us very well. So that kind of thing, we're hoping we can do a little more of in the future. But I will just caution people thinking about doing a full season cover and a grazing scenario on their crop ground. You really got to make sure that you're accounting for the cost of that land, because crop ground is more expensive than pasture land. And you can't let that go by the wayside because it does make a difference on the bottom line.
Right.
And, you know, if you ignore that, you're going to ignore some big dollars.
Right.
And it's been a good experiment. There's a lot of people that do it, and so it tells me that there is a way to definitely make it make sense. It's just, it's not as easy as one would think. You can't just jump into this, plant some cover crop, and have it make financial sense. You got to sit down and logistically plan things, make sure you account for all your costs before you jump in.
All right, so we said in the beginning here that you have a master's in economics, and this is a fourth, you know, you're in partnership with your dad, your uncle, your cousin. What are, for you, because you're a bottom-line guy, what are the intangibles here that sort of make this system attractive to you beyond just that, the you know, watching those numbers line up and seeing those cost savings? How do you sort of process that as a young farmer?
The intangibles are the two things I mentioned at the beginning about just a little bit ago, about why we started grazing cattle on the crop ground in the first place.
Yeah.
Soil health and animal health. Those are tougher to gauge. I can't sit down at my computer and crunch the numbers of the input cost of what soil health practically does for us. It's a hard thing to put a number to, you know what I mean?
Right.
And so that's a big intangible. We know it's better. You know, you can go out there and you can dig in the soil and the texture is better. There's the biodiversity is phenomenal. There's earthworms, there's mycorrhizal fungi, and all that sort of stuff that, in my opinion, is economically intangible.
Yeah.
And then there's the animal health, where you see bulls where they're in a feedlot and they beat on each other and they ride around and they get hurt. And when you look out into a quarter or a section of crop residue that bulls are grazing on, they're spread out, they leave each other alone, they get along. Another intangible that we know is good, but it's tough to quantify.
Yeah. Nick Jorgensen with Jorgensen Land and Cattle Partnership from Ideal. Thank you so much. We hope you'll come back and talk to us again. It's been really a delight to have you here.
Oh, thanks for having me. Appreciate it.